The radio program is about to begin. You will only hear the recording once.
Good afternoon, listeners. This is your old friend Sally Knight back with you again. Welcome to this week's edition of Planet Watch 2000. This is the third in a series of six programs where we examine man's relationship with nature. That relationship is becoming one of increasing concern as we reach the end of the 20th century. Today, we have with us two very special guests who have kindly agreed to tell us about the environmental work they're doing around the world. They belong to an organization called
the Green Earth Movement. That's GEM for short.
Thank you. And their names are Jerry Chase and Amanda Kwan. Now, you two only met each other recently, is that right?
It is, yes. Jerry is based in Europe, whereas I belong to the local branch of the organization. He is a field agent for GEM. Why don't you explain what that involves, Jerry?
Well, my job has changed quite a lot over the years. But what I do now is make video films. Amanda is my contact here in Hong Kong.
Yes, I am the public relations officer for GEM. As PR officer, my responsibility is to arrange presentations and things like that. Next week, there's a presentation about Jerry's video, a documentary about logging in Sarawak.
Okay. Now, we're going to talk a little about the topic of Jerry's video in the first half of this program. And while we're doing that, if any of you listeners at home have a question you would like to ask my guests today, please call our switchboard on 2589-9103. I'll say that again. That's 2589-9103. We'll be taking your calls in about 15 minutes. Jerry, tell us about your video. Where exactly did you make it?
In the jungles of Sarawak. Sarawak is a Malaysian state on the island of Borneo. It takes up most of the northwest coast, but the places I travelled to and where I saw the worst effects of logging were upriver, close to the border with Brunei.
And what sort of things does the video show?
Well, to start with, I wanted to film the tree-felling operations in the jungle. That is, show how they cut the trees down in the first place. I'll talk about the way they do this in a moment. At the same time, I tried to film the dangerous working conditions. These are particularly bad at the sites where the trees are being cut down. There are hardly any safety regulations to protect the workers there. Another aim of the video was to show how logging affects local communities. By local communities, I mean the native tribes who still live in the jungle. At the end of the video are some interviews with agents from logging companies in the regions. These were representatives for buyers with interests in Japan. I'll talk a bit more about Japan later.
The first part of the video reveals something very interesting, and that is that there is a huge amount of wastage in the trees that are being cut down.
Why is that happening? Is it really as bad as they say?
Well, that depends on who you mean by they. Government officials would tell you that they only cut down a limited number of trees. But while that may have been their original intention, it certainly isn't what's happening in reality. In many cases, there is a great wastage of trees for a number of reasons. The most important of these is the fact that the logging workers are not trained. Lack of training obviously leads to quite a few problems. The main one being that the workers ignore the regulations. Another problem is that they chop down the wrong trees. This is because they are told to go into the forest to look for suitable trees, but they are not told how to identify them. Finally, when they start chopping, They don't think about which way the tree will fall, so they damage other trees as a result. Those are the primary problems, but the situation is made worse when the logs are removed from the forest. This is where the skidder comes in. A skidder is a huge four-wheel tractor with a long chain with a hook on the end which can be attached to the log. The driver of this vehicle usually has no idea where the log he's looking for is located. He just drives around until he finds it, destroying plants and bushes on the way. The skidder will cause even more damage when it pulls the log out of the forest.
What a terrible situation.
Indeed. And what it means effectively is that for every one tree deliberately cut down, 10 other trees may be lost. The government calls it selective logging, but I'm afraid that in my view, it is in fact extremely destructive.
Tell us more about the conditions at the sites. You suggested that being a logging worker is a risky business.
That's something of an understatement. In one place I went to, called Merripit, the workers were using equipment which was badly maintained. Chainsaws with broken handles, ropes that could easily snap, that kind of thing. Many of the workers had no protective clothing on. They were just wearing jeans and t-shirts. To make it worse, the ground is usually very muddy, so they end up slipping all over the place. Sometimes I felt like I was back in the days of slavery.
These workers, as Jerry has mentioned, are mostly local tribesmen. Their conditions of employment are terrible. They only get money for what they produce. That is, they are paid piece rates by the logging company. As a result, they work very long hours, usually from the moment the sun comes up to when it goes down, and sometimes even into the night. The long hours obviously lead to exhaustion. When people get exhausted, they then get careless. Carelessness in this kind of work can have serious consequences. Workers are often injured and sometimes even killed. Do you know there were almost 100 deaths due to logging accidents in Sarawak last year?
100? Oh, that's astonishing.
As if that weren't bad enough, none of these workers had medical cover or insurance provided by their employers.
It's always the tribespeople who end up as the losers where logging is concerned. And I don't just mean the workers. I'm thinking also about the villages located near the logging sites. In the more remote villages, the tribespeople survive by hunting, farming and fishing. Well, let's take hunting to start with. Many of the animals the tribes once hunted have been frightened away by noise. The kind of noise that frightens them away is, you know, the wail of chainsaws and the engines of the skidders and the logging trucks. In addition, when they have free time, the workers shoot the animals. But they hunt them for entertainment only, not for food. How about farming then? Well, in many places this is still possible, but often, because of the logging operations, the tribes cannot practice crop rotation. Crop rotation refers to when farmers move their crops each year so that the soil doesn't get exhausted. The other problem is flooding. When there are no trees to absorb heavy rainfall, farms get washed away.
How's the fishing affected?
Well, the rivers get blocked up with mud. Fish can't survive in muddy water. Then there's the added problem of waste from the logging camps. The waste, which may be sewage or diesel oil or even chemicals used to treat the logs, pollutes the rivers, killing the fish.
One of the two greatest health problems facing the tribes now is therefore malnutrition. Basically, they don't have enough to eat because of the things that Jerry has just mentioned. The other main problem is disease, which is on the increase. Locked areas are ideal breeding grounds for mosquitoes. So there's a lot of malaria.
And presumably these things are threatening their very way of life.
That's right. Logging has great implications for their society. Many people are now moving towards the larger towns and cities where work is scarce. It is now more common for the men to get drunk, particularly if they cannot find a job. As for the women, many of them become prostitutes in order to make money. And one of the saddest sights in cities like Miri and Cebu is the children begging in the streets. These once proud tribes have been reduced to tramps and street sleepers.
That's very sad. But for now, let's go back to what happens to the logs.
Well, the logs are transported by boat to special storage camps along either side of the river. In these camps, the logs are piled up on top of each other. There are tens of thousands of them, and some of these piles are more than 20 feet high.
And I suppose they're waiting to be exported?
As a matter of fact, most of them are no use to anyone. They're often rejected by the buyers as unsuitable for exporting.
But why do the buyers think they're unsuitable?
Well, it could be that they're the wrong species of tree, that is, the wrong type of wood. And sometimes buyers don't like them because the wood is not perfect. There may be marks on it or other kinds of defects. The other thing is, some of the logs have been at the camps for years, so they've simply rotted.
And it was at these storage camps that you met the buyers?
Yes. I recorded a conversation with one of them without him realizing it. I pretended to be a heavy machinery expert, you know, interested in selling skidders or logging trucks, because they're very suspicious of environmentalists like myself, and he wouldn't have spoken to me otherwise. What I wanted to find out was, who allows the companies to operate on tribal land? Logging frequently takes place on property which has belonged to the local villagers for hundreds of years.
The way in which they lose their land involves a number of people. It starts when the government suddenly claims one day that it owns the land. This shows how much power officials have. Then the most senior man in the state, the chief minister, sells the rights to the land to anyone with enough money. He may sell it to his relatives, his friends, other politicians, who knows. Let's call these the middlemen. These middlemen then invite logging companies to start work on the land. And in come the trucks and the skidders. Millions of dollars pass hands during this process. But the tribespeople whose land it is receive hardly a cent. Unless, of course, they decide to help cut down the trees themselves.
The buyer I spoke to confirmed all of this, but it didn't seem to worry him. All he was interested in was making a big profit for his company.
And on that sober note, perhaps we'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll be taking some of your calls about this very interesting, if depressing, topic. And don't forget, that number is 2589-9103. Back in a moment.
That's the end of part one. You'll now have 5 minutes to tidy up what you've written. Part 2. In this part, you'll hear a phone-in question and answer session. You'll now have 3 minutes to familiarise yourself with the headings for Part 2. At the end of Part 2, you'll have 10 minutes to tidy up your answers.
Welcome back to the show, listeners. Let's go straight into the calls which Jerry and Amanda will take it in turns to answer. Right. And now we have James Parker calling from Mong Kok. James, what's your question?
Thanks. It sounds like the tribespeople are being treated very badly. Do they ever protest about what's happening?
Protest? Yes, some of them do. For example, there have been instances where tribespeople go to the law courts to fight. After all, the land is supposed to belong to them. But as you might expect, there are problems with doing this. One is that they usually have to travel a long way to get to a law court. They live in the jungle, and courts exist only in the big cities. Another problem is that they may have to wait many months before their case is heard. I know of one case where they had to wait for up to a year. A third problem is that of corrupt court officials. Villagers end up having to pay large bribes to get help.
It sounds as if it's hardly worth the effort.
You're right. That's why tribespeople sometimes protest in more direct ways. We know of one case in a place called Simbang, where the tribespeople destroyed bridges built by the logging company. The police acted quickly and arrested some tribesmen from a nearby village, although they didn't have any real proof it was them. Even so, they kept the men in jail for nearly 3 months without charging them.
Okay. Thanks for that question, James. Now, we have another caller on the line whose name is...
Simon Tong. My name is Simon Tong. I live in Sha Tin. I've been watching TV, and there seems to be a lot more forest fires, for example, in Indonesia. I wonder if you could tell me what causes those forest fires, and is there any relationship of these forest fires to logging?
Well, it depends which side you're on. The government would say that it's all the fault of the tribespeople. They say that the tribespeople burn down the trees so that they can plant crops, and that leads to fires which get out of control. Jem completely disagrees with this. I mean, it's ridiculous. Tribes have been using these techniques for hundreds of years. I mean, they know what they're doing. They know how to control the fires. The government is only saying that because they want to sort of back up the logging workers. And we know that the logging workers are untrained. They don't know how to set the fire safely. Well, the governments accuse us, they accuse Jem, of being all woolly about the tribespeople. They say that we're romantics. They say that we're ignorant. But that's just not true. Jem says that it's all the fault of the logging companies. The way they clear the land, it's not right. It's unsupervised, it's ignorant. The workers are burning down bushes so that they can get to the trees more easily. So basically what we're saying is that it's the logging company's fault.
A definite difference of opinion there. Thanks for that question. And we have another now from a Lama Island resident called Christina Ng. Go ahead, Christina.
Thanks, Sally. Your guests have talked about the tremendous wastage of trees in Sarawak, but obviously some of the wood is exported. My question is, what furniture do they use the wood for?
Well, as Japan is the largest exporter of logs from Sarawak, we did a study of how the wood is used there. The facts are very surprising. Like you, most people have the idea that tropical hardwood is used to make very high-quality furniture, like cabinets, tables and chairs, that kind of thing. But actually, hardwood is hardly ever put to these uses in modern-day Japan. More than three-quarters of the logs which are shipped to Japan actually end up as plywood. Sure, a small percentage of hardwood is still used on occasion for interior decoration in such things as luxury boats, and there are still one or two houses made with fine wooden beams shipped all the way from the rainforest. But you don't see many of those in Japan these days. Most of the buildings are prefabricated, and that's where plywood comes in.
Yes, these are the thin wooden sheets which are used in the construction industry to make the walls of buildings. Plywood is used all over the world, but in other countries it is usually made from low-cost softwood, which is specially grown. Only in Japan do they use wood from the rainforest to make these sheets. The advantage is that concrete walls in Japan have a much smoother surface than anywhere else.
How strange. So, trees which are hundreds of years old are being cut down, and tribespeople go hungry, all so that the residents of Tokyo can have smooth walls in their houses. Unbelievable! Anyway, we have our next caller, Andrew Wong from Saiwan Ho. Good afternoon, Andrew.
Good afternoon. I was listening to your program and I was following your discussion, and I have a question. I was wondering why cheaper wood isn't used for construction. You know, the reason of having smooth walls doesn't sound very convincing to me.
Well, let me give you a few reasons. It actually costs less to cut down a tree, ship it to Japan, and make it into plywood than using softwood from Japan. Okay? For example, workers in Japan have much higher salaries than those in Sarawak. In fact, the local people in Sarawak are paid very, very little. And then, land in Sarawak is free, providing some profits go to officials. But they have to pay for land rights in Japan.
And I'll be interested to know exactly how much hardwood is imported by Japan.
Oh, a lot. About 50% of Sarawak's logs are sent to Japan every year. And most of the rest are sent to Korea. And maybe just under a quarter goes to Taiwan, and then a little less goes to Hong Kong. Parts of Sarawak, actually, is almost a Japanese plantation, you know?
Thank you.
Thank you for those questions, Andrew. Now, Jerry, tell me, are people in Japan aware of what's happening?
Well, there is one group that we know of who have protested against the logging companies. This is the Japan Tropical Forest Action Network, or JATAN for short. The Tropical Forest Action Network is a well-organized, hard-working group, but it faces a number of problems. One is a lack of public support. Most people do not think of the world environment as a very important issue in Japan. The other main difficulty is that JATAN can't change the practices of the logging companies. Japanese companies are very big and very powerful, and they don't have much time for environmentalists.
Have JATAN had any kind of success at all?
Well, they have managed to get the companies to give some money to an environmental research fund, but they only give approximately $800 a year per company, which is about the price of a large business lunch in Japan.
Okay. Time for one more caller. A gentleman from Kowloon Tong. Your question, please.
Yes, I'm Alan Partridge. I'd like to go back to the issue of the tribespeople. Let's face it, most of them are poor, uneducated, and, well, just not civilized. So my question is, can they improve their standard of living without logging? Whether you like it or not, logging will bring some benefits to the people of Sarawak.
I agree that everyone must have the right to improve the standard of living, and that logging could be a way of helping the tribe's people do that. But the point Jerry's video makes is that each benefit has disadvantages. Okay, there are new road networks in Sarawak built by the logging companies, so you think to yourself the local people can get around more easily. Not true. Only logging trucks are allowed to use the road, so effectively there's no public transport. Sure, some families can now afford to send their children to towns for their education. There is no doubt that this is a great opportunity. But the disadvantage is, afterwards, the young people don't want to return to their village. They suddenly see the way of life there as very hard and very backward.
What implications does this have for the villages?
Well, the result is that some remote villages have only children and the very old living there. 10 years ago, I would have said that sensitive logging, that is, logging which is properly planned, could have helped improve the standard of living in Sarawak. Now, I think it's probably too late.
I can't say I agree with you there. I mean, surely if you chop down trees and and bushes and things like that. I mean, eventually they'll just simply grow again.
Oh, look, we're talking about trees here, not rice. You can plant a crop of rice and harvest it and plant it again the next year, but you can't do that with trees. Trees take a long time to grow. I mean, they're essentially a non-renewable source. And if we look at it worldwide, the whole thing is a catastrophe. In India, 95% of their rainforest has been wiped out. In Thailand, not much better, 85%. I can go on. Indonesia, 65%. Brazil and Sarawak, 55%. If that goes on in Sarawak, then in 15 years' time, I mean, there's just not going to be any trees left. And the horrible irony is that by the year 2013, Sarawak's going to be a net importer of hardwood.
Well, I have to say, that's one of the most depressing things I've heard lately. I had no idea the situation was so bad. Thank you, Jerry Chase and Amanda Kwan.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
For sharing this shocking information with us, and to those who called in with questions. And just to let you know that you can see a presentation of Jerry's video at the GEM headquarters in United Centre, Admiralty, on the 1st of May, where they'll also be talking about what you can do to help save what's left of the rainforest. Meanwhile, from me, Sally Knight, your host for Planet Watch 2000, it's goodbye for now. Coming up next, we have the news, followed by...
That's the end of the program. You'll now have 10 minutes to tidy up your answers. Keep your earphones on until you hear the announcement at the end of the 10 minutes.